Hello, everyone, and welcome to Naked Politics. This is a disclaimer. I am recording this first episode while I am on a road trip across the country and do not have access to the best equipment. So I apologize in advance for the sound quality. I promise that the sound quality will be better on future episodes. In the meantime, I hope you can enjoy it for its content, and we'll check back soon.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the very first episode of my new podcast, Naked Politics, with Katie Hill. So excited to have you here. So excited for this first episode. Some of you may have already listened to the teaser, and if so, feel free to skip ahead by a few minutes. But I'm going to play it again here. So here you go. Hi, it's me, your favorite former congresswoman. By the time I was 32 years old, I'd been elected to, served in, and resigned from Congress. I flipped a seat that had been red for 22 years, removing a popular Republican incumbent in the great blue wave of 2018, the year of the woman. I was one of the youngest women ever elected to Congress and became the vice chair of the Oversight Committee, a member of House leadership, and was called one of the rising stars of the Democratic Party. In the middle of it, I left my abusive ex-husband and he threatened to ruin me. He tried, and in coordination with Republican operatives and the right-wing media, distributed naked pictures of me, taken and shared without my consent, that millions of people have now seen. And they were shitty photos at that. A lot factored into my decision, but almost a year ago, I resigned from Congress. I gave my final speech on the floor of the House of Representatives, calling out the deep misogyny and double standard that exists in our political system, and promised that, though I'm resigning, we will not stand down. We will not be broken. We will not be silenced. We will rise and make tomorrow better than today. The entire system needs to be changed. And the only way to do that is by changing who's in charge. While I was in Congress, I served on three powerful committees. I met Donald Trump and saw that horrible spray tan up close. I pissed off some Democrats. I really pissed off Republicans. And I got to know all of them as more than who and what you see on the news. I saw how things work and how things don't work. Most things don't, which shouldn't surprise you. And now I want to use what I learned to help people understand what it is truly like, what we're really up against, and what it's going to take to dismantle those power structures holding us back. Because you know what? I have nothing to lose anymore. I don't have a re-election to worry about. I don't have party leaders to offend or communications people to stress over every tweet. I can tell you the naked truth. I can expose it all. There are a lot of podcasts out there that talk about politics. What's going on this week? Who said or did what? Analyzing the minutiae and gossip of the day-to-day in Washington. This isn't that. This podcast is where we can get dirty. I was an outsider who broke in. I felt all along like I was infiltrating some archaic, elitist institution that was not made for people like me. Oh wait, I was. To fix it, we're all going to have to see the political system for what it really is. Naked and exposed. Trust me, I know something about that. I'm Katie Hill, and this is Naked Politics. Honestly, what did you expect me to call my podcast?
I'm glad we got that out of the way. Just FYI, this podcast is going to vary from episode to episode. You might have noticed that this is a particularly long one. They are not all going to be that way. Sometimes we're going to have interviews with really smart people, including my friends. Other times it's just going to be me and my hot takes and getting straight to a point on a topic or current events or whatever it might be. Maybe it'll be a rant. We'll see. I have never done a podcast before, so we're just going to kind of feel this out as we go along. We also want your feedback. So if you go to the website, nakedpoliticspodcast.com, you can leave your comments there and we'd love to hear from you. We have a lot of resources available on the website in terms of voting and other things that you should know. And you can listen to all of the episodes there as well. Before we jump into the interview, I just really want to reiterate to everyone. I know that if you're listening to this, you're probably a political junkie and you've heard this a million times and are probably telling everybody already, but the vote is the most important thing right now. And every single state is going to matter. Not just the swing states, it's in every single state. Even if you think you're in a totally red state or a totally blue state, you have to show up because we need to show that we're winning, Joe Biden is winning, not just by a little bit, but by a landslide, not just by the Electoral College, but by the popular vote, so that when Donald Trump inevitably tries to claim voter fraud or that he lost because Democrats cheated, that the numbers are so overwhelming that just doesn't work. And that means that every vote everywhere is crucial. And you need to make sure that everyone you know is voting in every part of the country, that they're voting down the ballot because the congressional races and especially the Senate this time is at stake. And, you know, frankly, if Mitch McConnell still has control of the Senate, we are not going to be able to accomplish very much, even with a new president. So vote, vote, vote. Things are looking good so far in terms of the numbers of Democrats who have been showing up and voting early or mailing in their ballots. But we also know that Republican enthusiasm is incredibly high for those who support Trump, and they are going to show up day of. So those numbers are going to get closer, and we cannot take our foot off the gas. We cannot take anything for granted. It's the individual connections that people have that make a far greater difference than an ad on TV or anything else. So you telling your contacts specifically, one by one, giving them a call and telling them, hey, did you vote? I just voted. Did you mail in your ballot? Did you get your ballot? Oh, you having any issues with it? Oh, yeah, I didn't know much about this race about judge either. But if you don't really want to vote on that one, you don't have to. But here's what I learned. It really makes a huge difference. So do that, please. And with that, let's get to the actual interview. I'm so excited that my first interview is with Andrew Gillum, who is the former mayor of Tallahassee. He was the Democratic gubernatorial nominee in 2018, and he was first elected to local office at the age of 23. We got to know each other because we had two of the most spectacular scandals in recent memory. We'll talk about that scandal. Many of you have probably heard about it, but if not, you will. And frankly, there's a great deal of trauma bonding that has happened because of us both surviving these scandals and trying to move forward. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about all of that. It was just such a great conversation. And I think, you know, we talk about both of us kind of facing our demons with the scandals, both of us coming out as bi, how we're coming out of it and what we're going to do next. So thanks for tuning in. Enjoy the interview, and we'll catch up afterwards.
Welcome. Thanks for joining me. I'm so excited. I am pulling up just some notes in case I run out of things to talk about. But Andrew, for people who don't know you, I'll just give a brief introduction, but then I want you to kind of like introduce yourself. Okay. That's one of the things that I found empowering since everything else is like, well, empowering, but also hard. Like, how do you want to introduce yourself? From what I've got is you were the former gubernatorial candidate in 2018 for Florida. You were first elected to local office at the age of 23. You're the former mayor of Tallahassee. What else would you like us to know?
Well, I would add to that, Katie, first of all, it is good to be with you, Congresswoman. I'm a big fan, and I should also say really, really deeply appreciative to you for how you have helped to hold me during this transitional time. And I know we'll talk about it, but I wanted to throw that out there. What I would add to, I guess, introducing myself is I would say I am Andrew's son to Francis and Charles. My mother was a school bus driver growing up, and my dad was a construction worker. I am one of their seven children. Wow. All boys, and one girl, my baby sister. In fact, I, Katie, am putting together a care package that I am going to rush to FedEx when we're done, because my sister's taking the New York and Massachusetts bar on Monday and Tuesday.
Oh,
and so
amazing.
Gotta get her some snacks and all that stuff together. Also say I was born in Miami, Florida. Grew up in an area called Richmond Heights, which is at the bottom in Miami. Working class area. Went to church like every other day, if not every day, with my grandmother, who would drag me along with her. None of my other siblings would ever say yes. I often did. And I had the amazing opportunity to grow up in a really loving loving home, not a home without its challenges, but to two parents who loved me dearly and tried to pour as much into me to make me the best person I could be. And so I graduated from high school and was the first of my siblings to graduate from high school and the first to go to college. Wow. And to have my little brother and my little sister come behind me and do the same thing. It's inspiring to say the least. And now to have my sister about to be a barred attorney, I'm claiming that right now. She will pass the bar. But yeah, that's a little bit about my background.
That's awesome. Okay, great. I love how you sort of, and you have kids now.
There's that part. The updated part is I am a dad to three children. My youngest is Davis, he's three. Wow. And then I have twins, Jackson and Caroline, boy, girl twins. And they are 6 year, 6 year olds going on 40. and I'm married to my wife, RJ, who works as an executive at the Florida Dental Association. So, we got a busy household most days.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I can imagine 2 6-year-olds and a 3-year-old that must have been even crazier when you were campaigning. So,
Katie, that wouldn't even be the half of it. The truth is my, RJ is an amazing partner, and the fact that she was able to hold us all together for 2 years on the trail for me and beyond that, 16 years as a local government official, as a city councilman and as a mayor, when we decided about running for governor, it was when we had our twins and they were, 3 years old, they're young. But we felt like we had a handle on things. And then we get the surprise that we are going to have a third, and we had to revisit whether or not it made sense for me to continue down the road. And if I had to be honest about it, I'm not sure that my wife would have been, as supportive as she ultimately ended up being, if she could have expressed her full truth at that time. But how could you tell, your partner that they
already started it, right?
Like you were already, we had made the decision and we were 3 months out from when I was going to join.
I mean, but your heart was in it at that point, right?
But my heart was in it. A lot of effort, a lot of energy had gone in it. Yeah. I will tell you, if she had said at that time, baby, I know we talked about this before, but now that we've got, a third child coming along, I don't know how we're going to do this. And I don't want to do this without you. Yeah. Right. That would have made a difference to me, but
she didn't want to say that.
No, of course not. Of course not. And so we went forward, but in truth, it was extremely, extremely hard. I mean, I felt like I missed so much of almost 2 years of my third son's life. Katie, I didn't get emotional, really deeply emotional about the race until after the election. My staff had asked me to pull some pictures from my phone that I considered favored pictures that we would send out in an email. And I'm scrolling through my phone and I'm looking at these pictures. And of course my personal pictures are intermittent in it.
Right.
And, I see my kids' faces go from fat to thin and, they're this size. And the next time they come to here, when they stand next to me, and I kind of broke down because I was like, I missed a lot of that. I don't even remember some of this.
That must have been really tough.
We asked for it, I guess.
I mean, we sign up for it, right? I don't know if you ask for it, but you agree to it. You say that this is something that you're willing to kind of risk when when, you know, you make the ultimate decision to run. And I think that that's something that, you know, no matter what your political affiliation or anything like that, I think that the respect for the choice to run and the sacrifices that you make in doing so is universal, or at least it should be.
But. Well, I would agree with your latter part of that, which is it should be. And I think that's true regardless of political affiliation for me. I mean, when I see campaign commercials and I see candidates who are out there on the grind, I immediately have a feeling of connection to them because I know what that's like. I know what you're sacrificing. You can be the most ambitious person in the world. And I don't use the word ambitious as a pejorative,
right.
but a person with high ambition, as you want, this thing still takes a toll on you. You're still sacrificing in order to give. And in a perfect, you know, in a perfect scenario, we would have a system designed to make room for the whole person.
Right.
And I think, unfortunately, we've got a pretty one-dimensional system of how we see and expect our leaders to perform and to act. And if you act outside of that, you know, there, if you dare to show up as human, you know, hold the gates because the flood's coming in.
Well, and you and I are two of the most prominent examples of that.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's true. It's true. Yeah.
So do you want to talk about just kind of, you know, what happened with your race and afterwards and just sort of what you've been going through as a person? Because it's tough. And that's one of the reasons that I think you and I connected so much was that we have the last year when you say 2020 has been awful. I think, yeah, we can... I don't know. It's just been next level. So, do you want to just kind of?
Yeah. So I was in a 5-way primary for the Democratic nomination in Florida, and the first candidate to get in, and also the first candidate to be counted out, by pretty much, all of the incumbent, you know, press and news, outlets in the state of Florida, but we were hungry. And, I am sure you didn't have this experience, Katie, but I would spend 8 hours a day dialing for dollars.
Oh, no, I did.
At the end of, no, this is where our experience must differ. At the end of the day, I would have nothing. I'm just dialing. dollars.
Sometimes that was the case. Yeah, in the early days, especially. But yeah.
Well, I'm telling you, when everybody has written you off and every newspaper that anybody reads says this guy has no chance, I would spend time on the phone with these potential donors and we'd have great conversation, you know, 20-30 minutes of it, which is already a bad sign because you should never have to spend that much time, you know, asking. And then at the end they go, oh, but I'm supporting candidate such and such, but you're such a nice guy. And you couldn't tell me that in the first couple of seconds. Seriously. Gosh. And I would
More discouraging than that. Just like back to back phone calls of nothing.
Of you're a nice person and good, you know, good
luck in your future
because you've
endeavors.
Got a bright future. Yeah. All of that. So, I mean, but I was getting it it felt like that was the routine. And it took off so many layers of confidence for me. And then having to wake up because I've got these great volunteers and these young people who are showing up in the office and they are giving it their all.
Yeah.
And I knew that I couldn't let them believe that I didn't believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so even when the news of the day did not seem positive, when there wasn't, you know, it didn't feel like there was an opportunity at all that we were going to get through this thing, you had to shoulder it. You had to come in and you had to say, okay, team, you know, let's get to it. We got to keep working, that kind of thing. And all in that primary, we raised the least amount of money of any of the candidates. I think I spent $6 million in the primary, and my opponents collectively spent almost $100 million. So it was crazy. And again, very few people thought we could win that race. And when I won the primary, obviously, I became the first African-American in the history of the state of Florida to lead the top of the ticket for either party. And in Florida, and you may be able to relate to this. Actually, I think y'all have a little bit more distance in California, but in Florida, the primary is extremely close to the general election. And the intent there is distance, obviously, so the intent is to protect the incumbent. Right, you don't want people to have the opportunity to get to know who this new person is. And so I went from like a choo-choo train to a bullet train, overnight. Mm-hmm. I went from raising $6 million to, 30 days later, raising $50 million. Our race, I think, in total cost $55 million on my side. I went from having a pretty good sense of how the day was supposed to go to having no clue where I was going, who I was talking to, what I was supposed to say until I was, there. 5 minutes out, from the event. So it was a whirlwind. It was crazy. It had so many highs and so many lows.
Yeah.
The only thing I would change would have been the outcome.
Sure.
But we put everything that we could into that race. I traveled to every single part of the state, red, blue, purple, you name it. We were there. And I honestly thought we were going to win that race for governor every day.
Well, and it was so close, wasn't it?
Yeah, we were the closest race for governor in 20, almost 30 years in the state of Florida for a Democrat. I got closer than all five of my predecessor nominees in the state of Florida, a difference of 30,000 votes out of a state of 20 million people. So it got, pretty crazy close. And the night of the election, I'm in the hotel room awaiting results. I had already gotten dressed. My wife was someplace else getting all made up.
Yeah.
And I remember my chief strategist and campaign manager coming into the room, and it was just me and the makeup, the woman who was doing makeup for us. And they looked, pretty, as you can imagine, just sort of blank face. And I said, "So what's going on? How's it going?" And they said, "Well, it looks like it's going to be a long night." And I'm like, "Oh, really? Okay, long night." Because I'm not watching television. I'm not doing anything. I'm trying to not think about whatever, laying back on the bed. And so we waited a little bit longer. But I had this feeling after seeing their faces. I thought, we're going to lose. Mm. Dumb me, I would not read. And I asked my comms guy not to even prepare a concession speech.
Yeah.
So then in that moment, as I started to think about, okay, we're gonna lose, I started to think about, well, what do you tell all those people that are assembled, out there for this rally and that kind of thing? And the second time that they had come in, I had asked, they gave me the update. And at that time they were like, "You're down by, 80, almost 90,000 votes." Mm-hmm. And then I said, okay. My wife is in the room at this point, and two of my other strategists are in the room at this point. And I say, "Well, are there enough votes out there for us to come back?" And one of the staff said, "No, Mr. Mayor, there aren't enough votes." And so I see everybody's faces looking like, of course, like they probably should look like we're just about to die. And I said, "Okay, all right, I got it. We got to go. Let's get in the cars and let's go." And we, he's got to tell everybody and let him go. And I don't know what came over me. I think it was, I didn't want to have to settle with like asking more questions about it. I just wanted to rip the Band-Aid off at this point. It was just like, let's go get it done. And so my wife looks at me and she said, what's going on? What's happening? And I'm like, we're not going to win the race tonight. And I don't want to keep people waiting. Let's just go in and concede and, let folks move on. And we got in the elevator. My mother wouldn't come with us. My mother-in-law wouldn't come with us. The kids, basically all my closest relatives wouldn't travel with us over.
Yeah,
very much so. And we got in the elevator. And I remember the elevator gets down to the lobby level. And in Florida, both the candidates have security at this point because you don't know who is going to win.
Right.
And I get to the lobby and everyone is broken up. I mean, my staff, tears are running down their face. And of course, I'm like just trying to keep it together and not feel anything. And we walked past this one security woman who was going to be assigned to my wife, and she was crying. Now, these people are supposed to be non-political, right? Not, you know, neutral. And again, we're like reminding ourselves, keep it together, keep it together, keep it together. Got in the car. I called Ron DeSantis and, you know, congratulated him. And he said, well, this night didn't go the way I had expected. And I thought, oh, well, he thought he was going to lose too. So did I. And, you know, I get over, we go out there. I say whatever is on my heart by way of a concession. And we turn around and try very hard to get, you know, through this thing and back into the cars. And we got from out of camera view behind the stage, and my wife like literally collapses into my arm. And at that point, we're like, we got to get out of here. And you know, it was crazy. So that was the night of. And I'm not sure at what hour it was. We just went back to our house. Everyone else stayed at the hotel, and we just laid in the bed with our clothes on, just sort of silent. And I started getting text messages from my campaign manager, basically saying, hey, the clicker on these numbers are going down, and they're going down pretty fast. So we're 90,000 votes out, then we're 80, then we're 70, now we're 60. I wake up the next day and we're, you know, we're 40,000 votes out. And then they tell us there are, you know, tens of thousands of votes left to cast. And at this point, I'm like, wait a minute. Y'all told me there were not enough votes.
Yeah, did I do this too early? Know? Yeah.
Yes, yes. I had that sinking feeling that maybe I'd done the wrong thing. And I had to then go back and say that I retracted my I did retract, and we wanted every vote to be counted.
Yeah.
And you know, the next week went on. My race got thrown into an automatic recount along with Senator Bill Nelson, and ultimately, in the final analysis, both he and I lost. Again, both by the closest margins for statewide races in Florida. So,
yeah,
that was a long way to get to we lost, huh?
No. I mean, it was I think it's the human experience of it, because especially, you know, if you lose in a huge margin, you just kind of have to accept it, right? But if it's something that it's so close and then it's dragged out and you don't know. I think the sense of responsibility that you've got for other people and the people who worked so hard and fought so hard for it. You know, it's not just you. It's not just you at all. And that's really, really heavy.
It was.
And you had to be so strong during all of it too. You couldn't show emotion. You couldn't, you know, show.
Katie, I would say it wasn't even, couldn't show emotion. Like I couldn't even feel.
You had to put that protective.
Absolutely. Yep. I didn't want my family to break. I didn't want my team to break. I didn't want anybody to break. And so I couldn't break.
Yeah. You couldn't let yourself. Yeah.
At all. And again, like I said, it was months later before I had, what I would consider, you know, a little bit of a breakthrough. And that's when I was looking at the pictures of my kids.
That
was the first time that I felt the real flush of emotion. This was a month after everything, about a month later, because I was choosing these pictures as a end of the year wrap up. So it would have been in December. It was a little bit later in December, but between that time, I was lethargic. I mean, feeling a bunch, trying very, very, very much not to think about, I'll tell you the honest truth, which is I watched so much thoughtless reality television that I needed to know that somebody else's life was fucked up and that, you know, that got me a far enough distance. And then the drinking started, because it was for me in a much easier way to not have to care. It was at first, you know, drinking a little bit more so that I could go to sleep at night, because it was hard to get to sleep. And then it was drink a little bit more because I don't have to travel today. And that means I don't have to be responsible to anybody and, you know, whatever. And then it was...
And why not? Because, like, you just feel shitty, so, you know.
Yeah, for very much so. And Katie, just on that point, feeling shitty and feeling out of use, right? I'm elected since I was 23 years old, completely feeling out of use. My term as mayor coincided with the election for governor, so... Mm-hmm. You know, I was no longer, in my opinion, I was no longer really useful.
Right.
And so I said yes to practically everything anybody was asking me to do. Will you come speak here? Will you join this campaign to do this? Will you, go be a commentator on CNN? Will you go and travel and join this board and that board? And I said yes to everything, even if I didn't sincerely feel a yes to it, because I felt like if I could be of use, then maybe this would feel a little bit better.
Right.
And I traveled more places. I took some vacations. I made more money than I had ever made in my adult life. Obviously, you started 23 as an elected official. You're not making much money, right? And was completely unhappy, unfulfilled, big voids.
Immediately in the months following.
This all starts in the months following. Yeah. Over the course of 2019, I mean, it was all of that. I mean, I went back and looking through my calendar, for 2019 and, like in the month of February, I think I was home 6 or 7 nights. March comes along 10 nights.
That's immediately, you took no recovery, basically.
There was no recovery whatsoever. Yeah. And the truth is that I don't even know that I wanted it. What was I going to do? Sit home and write journals? Like, that was not how I had lived my life for so many years.
Right. You needed to
even
fill
when
that
I wasn't
space.
Elected, right? Yes. When I wasn't elected, I was an activist. Right. I was leading protests and marches and, different groups and organizations. And so to go from that to like, oh, you get to live in the city that you were once mayor of, which also happens to be the state capital, where the guy who beat you by 30,000 votes happens to reside. And it's the most political place you can imagine in the state of Florida.
And also it's daily like a reminder. Disaster because of him. Like it's, how horrible that is, but. So you got out of that. You kept yourself busy for 2019 and sort of the drinking escalated.
Yeah. And for me, it became pretty clear that when I would, in the morning, when my cup was no longer filled with coffee and it was actually just dark liquor, but because I had a coffee cup, nobody would ask any questions. Mm-hmm. I knew that it had gotten, pretty bad for me. But nothing that happened to me during that period of time was enough to have stopped me.
Right.
So I would, my wife and I might go out and we might have dinner with some folks. And she told me this later. And I kind of remember this in the moment of, I'd get a drink, from the bar and then I'd be like, oh, this is so, so weak. What is this? All cranberry juice or whatever it was. I'd say something. But her point was that every time I got a drink, it was never, enough. It was always done wrong. It was always, to something.
Right,
And really what it was is, I had gone into the pantry before we left and I had my own drink before we got to the place and then I drank and then on the way home, she'd fight me about driving, you're not driving. No, you're not, this is another thing. So there were things that happened, at different points along the way that should have been enough to be a clue that things were going in the wrong direction. But nothing big enough had happened up until that point.
Right.
I could still do television, even if I was a little, on the tip.
Shoot, my television's better if I'm tipsy.
So. I have to tell you, there was this one time I was on the network and I felt pretty good about how it went afterwards. And the truth to God is no. I it was so good because I was a little lit.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
no, from it. So yeah. It was, so yeah, there was some of that in there as well.
You gotta have the right amount. Like you can have like a glass or two of wine or equivalent, but you can't have too much.
Yeah. I wish wine had been my problem, yeah. But, you know, the truth is I knew what alcoholism looked like because my dad was an alcoholic growing up. One of the best men I knew when he wasn't drunk, you know, was there for us, would come to the games, would, you know, be the one who would pick us up, you know, from school if it was going to be a situation and we needed him. And then when he would get over intoxicated, he became the meanest guy I ever right. knew. But mostly to my mom and mostly to my older siblings. But I'd never forget those, but I didn't act out that way. Right. And so in some ways I kind of talked myself into believing my problem can't be that bad. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Can't be that bad. 'Cause I can still do everything I need to do.
Yeah. And you hadn't had problems with it before, right? This was kind of your first real.
That's exactly right. I mean, I didn't drink much through college. And I had become an elected official so early and everybody's eyes felt so scrutinous. Mm-hmm. Like I wouldn't drink a lot, you know, out. And even right. if I were drinking, I would tell myself, I'm not going to drink now for 2 weeks
right.
or for a month. And if I could mm-hmm. get, you know, that was my way of self-regulating, like, okay, if I know I can tell myself to stop and not do it, then I'm good. 2019, I didn't even tell myself to stop, but, you know, into 2020. I mean, I ran through the stop sign, through the stoplight, over the speed bumps. It took a boulder, you know, happening in my life for me to really say, holy, you know, like something's up. This is a problem.
So were you hiding it from your family at that?
As best I could. I mean, that's one of the hardest things. And I know that to be true about recovery period is that the people who are the closest and the ones who are around you start to then retrace and they want to know, how did I miss mm-hmm. this? Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't see this. And part of it is I'm pretty, you know, I can be pretty functional at the things that I need to do.
I mean, you know, my brother died in the beginning of the year, from an overdose. And so he was an addict. It wasn't drinking that was the issue, but, he dealt with it since he was 15 years old. And, and we thought he was clean. He'd gone through, you know, therapeutic boarding school. He'd graduated, he'd done sober living, he'd gone through everything. And he'd even gotten clean enough to join the military, was in the military. And so we didn't know, we had no idea that like he just hit it so well that we, you know, we don't even know when he relapsed or anything. And I was with him, you know, the night before. So you're just replaying it over and over of like, what signs did we miss? But the truth is like people who are suffering from addiction, you know, you're very, I don't know if it's a coping mechanism or what, but a self-protection kind of thing, but you're very capable.
And you're good at faking it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You're good at faking it. You know that there are things that people are going to be looking for and watchful for.
Right.
And so, you know, you do your best to make sure that you bring, you know, that guard down enough for observers so they don't think anything's wrong. So absolutely. I mean, that's one of the first things they were telling us when we got to, when I eventually got into rehab was like, you know, you guys have been, you know, to put it bluntly, bullshitting yourself and everybody around you for however long it's been. Yep. And we're not doing that here. And it sort of got real from that point, you know, all the way through. And it was an important thing to say to all of us because nobody had ever called us out in that way. Certainly nobody had ever called me out in that way.
Right.
And so to hear it was like a little bit of a punch in the gut. Like,
sure,
you see me, you kind of see. You see this
behind the facade or whatever. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely.
So how about, I know that this is the hardest part to talk about, but how about that boulder? When you say that, you know,
I mean, Miami, it's just how I refer to it, where essentially on Friday the 13th,
of course,
of March. it becomes publicly known that I was in a hotel where someone had overdosed, and all that they knew about me was that I was unconscious when they arrived. And although, you know, the person recovered and, you know, there was a third person whom I wasn't aware of, was apparently not sick or didn't have anything happen with him, as at least the police report had read. I knew that, you know, this was going to be, you know, the biggest shitstorm that there ever was.
Right, right.
And for, you know, and for the hours after, you know, getting woken up and sitting in a hotel bathroom with no clothes on, with no clue about what happened,
how you got,
why I don't have clothes on. They're telling me someone has overdosed, and pardon me, but when I heard the word overdose, I thought that meant someone had died.
Died, yeah.
And that the police officers told me that they were potentially investigating a homicide.
Oh, shit.
And so I'm just, you know, I'm sitting here, I'm in total shock.
You're like, what?
I have no memory aside from arriving at the hotel to see a person who I knew, who we had enough of a relationship to trust each other, that the last memory I have of being conscious in the hotel room is sitting on the little couch area drinking.
Right.
And then to wake up and to be in a bathroom with no clothes on, surrounded by, I don't know, 4 or 5 officers with body cameras,
God,
facing directly at you, and for probably an hour not being offered so much as a towel to wrap myself in.
Oh, geez.
I mean, I was, it felt like a total out of body experience.
I can only imagine, yeah.
No real feeling like it. I mean, right. I was in total shock about, you know, what had gone on. I felt, it almost feels like I would have preferred to be able to know everything that happened so that I could recount it.
Sure.
And therefore it would feel like it made more sense.
Mm-hmm.
But in this instance, I literally had 30 minutes of, you know, time to waste before I was supposed to be someplace else. I was in Miami for vacation. I was going to preside over the wedding of a friend.
Oh my gosh.
I ultimately did preside over a wedding for a friend.
You did? Wow.
I ended up doing it. I was supposed to go and pick up the rental car from the airport and meet my friends and my wife at the rental house.
Oh my gosh.
I get the text, hey, I'm here. Are you still on the beach? Because I told him I was on the beach. It was vacation. Vacation had gotten started for me already. I'd been drinking.
Yeah.
And so it was supposed to be a quick pass through. This is 6 o'clock in the afternoon, 6 o'clock in the evening. And then I'm supposed to go, you know, carry on. I wasn't going to be able to get the car anyway, cause I was already kind of two sheets to the wind, but
now this was the day before.
Yeah. This is the 12th.
Okay.
So this is the night of the incident.
That's when you officiated the wedding.
I officiated the wedding the next day. I officiated
on the 13th.
Officiated the, yeah. So, oh, no. This will now be the 14th.
Okay.
So
got it.
Thursday night is the hotel incident. Friday morning, the 13th, is when all hell breaks loose.
Right.
And then the wedding is on that Saturday. And I told the couple that I would, that I would encourage them to go with a different friend of ours to preside over the wedding, and that I couldn't do it. And their response to me was, we love you. And we are glad that you are safe. And if you don't marry us, we won't get married this weekend.
Whoa.
And of course, at that point, you know, you do what you got to do. You stay in there for your friends.
So surreal though.
All of it was surreal. So this is when I remember being in the bathroom with the police officers and asking, what time it was because I didn't have anything on me. I didn't have my cell phone. Eventually somebody brings me my clothes and, to put on. And as I'm putting them on, I'm realizing that it's all soiled, like my shirt's soiled and my, and I'm not really sure why it's soiled. And I later learned that it's puke.
Yeah.
And they say it's almost midnight. And I'm like, what? Everybody's going to be crazy. It's almost midnight. I was here. Yeah, I got here at 6. I was supposed to be going at 7, 6:30, 7. And I mean, just lost the whole day. And I get back to, they end up not taking any formal statement from me, which I thought was interesting.
Weird.
They were asking me questions in the bathroom. It feels a little kind of hairy, but it was just sort of like, sir, I have no idea what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm sure they thought I was lying, off my ass, but I was telling them the truth. I had no idea. I was like, and who is sick and what happened? And this is that in the third. And I get an Uber. I get to the rental house. Everybody's asleep except my one friend who lets me in. And I could not go to sleep. This is 1, 2 or whatever in the morning. I'm calling the hospital to find out how, the guy is doing. They will not give me any information. And then at 6 a.m., I get a call from him and he sounds like he is, he's on his second wind. Hey, what's up? And I'm like, jeez, are you alive? I thought you would, what happened? And, I'm dreading this whole time that I know that tomorrow there or today now, cause it's 6 a.m. Mm-hmm. that the police report will be filed at any moment and it will be public. And I'm not sure what it's going to say. I'm not sure what images will be included in it. I'm not sure of any of that. And, I wake my wife up and I tell her that we need to talk. And she's, of course, pissed off at me like nobody's business because she hasn't heard from me. She had to take, a sleeping pill just to get to sleep because she was so worried. Yeah. She later told me that she thought that I may have had the rental car and gotten into an accident.
Oh, gosh.
She had been concerned about my drinking and thought that maybe because I couldn't be reached that something bad had gone on and had gone so far as to call around the hospitals and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so clearly pissed and completely not ready for, me having to tell her that, hey, I was passed out in this hotel room with this other guy who you don't actually know. And the police thought that there may have been a homicide because he overdosed on I'm not sure what. And I'm so sorry, but this is all going to be public, in a matter of, I don't know when, but at some point today.
Yeah.
And obviously you can imagine, just a unbelievable, conversation.
Oh, yeah.
And, while we are in the car, because we're driving around, I wanted to get her out of the house so that we could talk. We got in one of our friends' vehicles and we're driving around and all of a sudden my phone lights up. And at this point I'm like, okay, it must be out. And it's a certain media personality, I won't say her name, who apparently has screenshots of the police report. And she tweets them out to the world, this police report. So it's not been officially released yet. This is a copy that somehow she was able to get her hands on and basically pushed it out there. And all I can say, Katie, is if there was ever a moment that I did not want to be on this earth, it was like that moment.
Yeah, I mean, I'll never forget the moment that the picture that I saw my pictures and just like the sinking feeling in your gut of like, how do I really can't even describe it. But you have, there was a picture that was released of you too, right?
There was of me on the floor, passed out naked.
So where did that come from? Do you know who released it? Or
I don't know officially, but I could tell you there could have only been one person.
But it wasn't one of the, was it one of the cops or no?
No, because it was a picture that was taken from within the room before law enforcement got there.
Got it.
And so, and again, Katie, the difference here is that I learned about everything that I could basically by looking at pictures.
Jeez.
You know, yes, I didn't know that I had been laid out in the floor in that condition. And then to not be able to answer
what happened
myself. Mm-hmm. And then the people who were closest to me, the people who I love, was horrible. And so I just went into what I knew, which was, okay, take responsibility for everything.
Right.
And then just move on.
Yeah.
I made bad judgment. I did this, I did that. But I will tell you, and I've learned, and am learning this through my own therapeutic process, is that something went down that was very foul. And I don't care what judgments I made.
Yeah.
I didn't deserve to have pictures of me in my most vulnerable
and
unconscious state passed around for someone's fodder.
So that's what I was going to say, is you don't hear about this with your case as much, but you're a victim of cyber exploitation too. And it's the same kind of thing that happened with me, in terms of someone took photos of you without your consent, naked and vulnerable, and they posted them, they shared them.
Yeah.
And you know, that is the definition of cyber exploitation. And so, you know, I think that we have to, no one deserves that. It doesn't matter what you did to end up there. Sure. You were, you know, you made mistakes, you, whatever. I mean, it doesn't matter. There is never a time in which it's okay to do that. That is a form of assault. And we need to see it that way. So,
you know, what's crazy, Katie, is that I probably all the way up until maybe a month ago, had not internalized that I could feel that way.
Yeah.
All that I had thought was,
it's my fault.
All of your decisions are what got you to this moment, and you just have to own it. And I think politics teaches us that. I think when we put ourselves out there as leaders, it teaches us that. And just because we were taught those skills for survival in public service doesn't make them right.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that you deserved what happened.
No, no, never. So then you started a separate recovery process of like trying to kind of overcome that. And I remember when it happened, you and I weren't in touch then. My brother had just died, but I was just so sympathetic for you, because I was like, this is deja vu of what had happened with me. It was, you know, obviously slightly different, but it felt so, so similar. And so I remember, you know, you went off the grid, I guess, so to speak, for
went to rehab.
Yeah. So you checked in somewhere.
Oh yeah. Yeah. 3 days later I was in rehab, where, I had to decide that it was time to save myself. And while in my situation, it's complicated by all, you know, all of these many factors, I knew that if I did not get this alcohol thing under some control, which is to basically say that I am out of control,
right?
That things could get a lot worse. And so it was the last place on earth I wanted to be. I remember when I first got there, probably the first, you know, 2 weeks, I kept looking for all the things that made me different from everybody else that was in rehab. I kept listening to their stories so that I could hear something that would say, oh, well, that's not me. I never did that. Da, 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 da.
Yeah.
And my therapist while I was in rehab said, you know, Andrew, I know this has got to be tough for you, but if you could just allow yourself to listen with compassion to your peers that are here, I promise you that you're going to find that you got more alike than you have different. And you've got a choice to make here. You can save face or you can save your ass. And he pierced me because I was still wearing layers. I was still the former mayor and the former Democratic nominee for governor. And I'll put on a good face and go to all these classes every day for 7 days a week for 45 days or whatever. But I'm doing it because I know that this is something that I have to do. So once I allowed that to break through, he was completely right. I started hearing, I was like, man, I remember feeling that way. And sure, oh God, I remember that too. And whew, that was embarrassing. And, you know, I have that same shame that, so it's that like she's talking about.
So it's almost like at first you went because you knew you had to, and that was kind of your only path forward to, I don't know, for whatever future you wanted to have. But then you hit a point where you're like, no, this is real and I need this for myself and for my family.
Yes. Well, I went because it was an ultimatum from my wife.
Oh, well,
that was the reason. I mean, there was no thinking outside of that. It was, you have to go and get help. Because I don't know what happens with us, but our three kids need a dad. And that's what it took to get me there. Now, what it took to get me in the game was somebody starting to help me break down the wall and pay attention to the fact that I was in crises.
Yeah.
And even though I was in crises, I was still in denial about the crisis I was in.
Yeah. So you did 45 days and then you've done, you know, all kinds of therapy since then, I'm sure.
All kind of therapy, marriage counseling. I have my own individual life coach and therapist. I have a group of folks that I work with, in AA, a much smaller knit group of similar folks around the country. And that was a very generous offer by friends out there who just wanted to make sure I was going to be okay and was able to do this thing with some level of not anonymity, but without shouldering all that comes with, you know, being who you are and without being who you are. And it's just been a journey around trying to unpack, like, what's in my pleasure? What has existed that's kept me from being able to be whole and complete and honest with myself? And, you know, I guess there's no better way to put it than in my own happiness.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that up to that point at the age of 41 that I haven't been happy. I've been extremely happy at different moments. But I have also felt at different moments the need to keep certain things to myself. And one of those things was you know, my sexuality, which Miami sort of opened the door to everyone just sort of placing their own labels on me.
Right.
They had made up in their head about what all went down and why it all went down and so on and so forth.
And the media fodder and the right wing media and everything. God,
all of it. Right. And what I knew about that is that there was an element of truth because I knew about my own sexuality. I knew that there is an element of there being a question about sexuality, but all the other stuff that had gotten sort of all the other narrative that had gotten pieced together was not true. And the reason why, when I first talked after being away for about 6 months, the reason I talked first about alcohol is because I didn't want to suggest that alcohol is an influence on someone's sexuality. I didn't want to conflate all of the negatives that people have already made up in their mind about, you know, LGBT individuals, but mostly about, you know, about gay men. I didn't want to add additional injury to that. Now, I couldn't control all of it, so whatever injury had happened, regardless of what my steps were, was painful, but I at least wanted to put people in a place where I could state my truth, and also, you know, in my own way, just let folks know that I've got my own devils that I've had to deal with as it relates to alcohol. But I didn't want that conversation to have to sit side by side with sexuality, because although, you know, I am bisexual, the world that we all live in sort of causes all of us to have to think, you know, in these false dichotomies.
Right.
That you're either gay or you're straight. And
yeah, you and I have talked about this a lot, that being bisexual immediately puts you into this kind of construct of being hypersexual, or of being, you know, promiscuous, and of being a risk taker. And, you know, the rates of sexual assault among bisexual individuals is so much higher than either gay or straight people. So I think, you know, you basically talked about your experiences with alcohol first, and then a little bit later, you talked about, you came out basically.
I did. Okay. And that was, extremely difficult.
Yeah.
Mostly because I was concerned for my wife. She knew that I was bisexual because I revealed that to her when we were dating. So it wasn't news, you know, it wasn't news to her. It wasn't news to us for, you know, 16, 17 years. And it was my wife's position, and I don't think she would get mad at me for saying this, but she, you know, her position was basically, I don't care what they rumor about. Nobody is entitled to our bedroom. I know what people think. I know what they say. This is that and the third, but that is between you and I. Exactly. Yeah. And I said to her that I wish, you know, I completely understand what is personal being personal, but for me, it isn't just about people being in our bedroom. It's also about a part of my identity. That for my purposes, I want to say, because I don't want anybody to think they have anything on me. You don't own, you don't get to, you don't get to hold something over my head or create my truth because a void that I left by not telling it. And so I had, you know, part of our therapy was me and her working through why I felt the need, you know, so, you know, badly to sort of say. And, you know, she felt very strongly about sort of, you know, protecting me, protecting her, protecting our family. But she eventually, you know, got around to it where she said, you know, I'll stand with you in that. But it was, we had talked about it on three separate occasions since our marriage about me making that part of my life public. And obviously it didn't happen up to that point, but it had been something that sort of had been tugging at me for some time, and for no other reason than just wanting to, like, not have, it's such an important part of who you are not to acknowledge, it felt like, in some ways for me, but I also knew the consequences of it. Yeah. You know, I was raised in the church, I've lived in the Black community still, you know, all my life. I knew what people said. I know because my brother, you know, right above me is gay. When he came out, you know, moved from Florida to California just to get away from some of the hateful things that were said by members of our own family. So I watched.
So because it was hard enough for me as a white woman, that's, you know, even younger. But for you as a Black man coming out as bi, like, can you just kind of touch on that really quick of like why, what makes it so different?
Well, it makes it really different. At least I can just say, maybe not the differences, but what it does feel like is that for many Black men, they probably have grown up with grandmama going to church and granddaddy going to church and mama, and, you know, faith is such a huge aspect of our social life, of everything that goes down. And some pretty toxic things have also been preached and taught from that perch. And so, you know, immediately it's a sin. It's, you know, not what God, you know, would want. It is, you're going to die, you know, from disease. It is, it's you're not a man. Mm-hmm. That one is a pretty consistent one.
Yeah.
It's weak. It's, there's nothing positive associated with that as an identity. And I will tell you, I've experienced, particularly in the Black male gay community, a very similar discrimination where it is, well, you just don't know what you want, mm-hmm. right?
Oh, yeah.
Or you're just in the process, mm-hmm. but what you are is really gay. And I said, well, when I wake up one day and I'm no longer interested in women and in my wife, then I'll believe you. But that actually just that isn't my experience. Yeah. And so, and I have to tell you, Katie, when I was young, when I was in high school trying to figure this out, because it really sort of clicked for me in high school when I had to read James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room.
Really interesting. Okay.
Yeah. A book about a bisexual man who's in Europe for the summer and is intended to be married and all this kind of to a woman and gets into a relationship with a man. And I couldn't even finish reading Giovanni's Room in high school. I ended up ultimately getting the Cliff Notes and like cheating to get this paper written.
Because it
had struck such a nerve. It was the first time that I had seen myself reflected. I was like, that starts to make a little bit of sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And all the while I'm talking to my brother in subtle ways, trying to like place myself, just trying to map myself.
Right.
And I'm listening to him to tell his story about being gay. I was like, well, I don't kind of feel that way.
Right.
And that doesn't feel quite right. And so I was just struggling because I didn't completely understand what it was, right? and I think partly that happens in all communities, but it's mm-hmm. certainly pronounced in the Black community. Like I said, it's like you're gay or you're straight.
Yeah.
You know, you're a man or you're a, I won't say the word, right?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's these very hard edges and you're in one thing or you're in another. And, you know, where you and I sit is a much more, you know, challenging place. And I think part of what makes it so challenging is who wants to come out as anything if you're already in a relationship?
Right.
So part of it is like, If you're a bisexual man, but you're in a same-sex relationship, everyone just assumes you're gay.
And it's easier to deal with.
Or you're a lesbian. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I wish that in some ways it's like, God dang, if that could be true, then it's black and white and you can just say what it, you know, say what it is.
Yep.
If you are bisexual and you are in a differently gendered marriage, then you're straight.
Yep.
And you just don't make any declarations about it one way or another, but this is a different posture.
Right.
And the biggest misnomer I think, you know, a lot of people have is that then, you know, they draw the conclusion is, oh, okay. So then what it is, you just, you know, go out and you have sex with whomever, you know, you want. You just want to do this, that, and third. And
whatever,
then they, And then they relate it to immediately being non-monogamous.
Mm-hmm,
it
mm-hmm.
It is immediately, you're an alien. What you're is so strange. And I said, well, let me just put it to you this way. You're a straight man. You're married to a woman. Do you no longer find women attractive? No, of course. You know, then I find women attractive. Well, do you then sleep with every woman that you find attractive? No. I'm not going, you know, I'm married. This, that, and the third. Well, it's the same choice that people make. Now, whether you're monogamous or not, or whatever, it's, you may have attractions to different people, but you make those decisions.
Yes.
And if your marriage is situated that way, if your relationship is that way, look, full-fledged, loving, caring, consenting adults can define the relationships of their choosing. So this is not a put down on anybody's anything, but don't make me a foreigner simply because my attractions can be greater than what yours are.
Right. And you're right. That's exactly what keeps so many of us. I mean, that's why bi visibility is such a big deal and why I was so happy when you did come out, because there are just not that. I mean, I couldn't think of another bi man in politics that is out and certainly not a black man. And so I think, you know, just knowing how important it was for people that I was out was, you know, it's just huge. And it just means so much when it's easier to keep it separate, right? So if you've been in a relationship for, you said you were together for 16, 17 years. Why would you broach that?
For sure.
And I decided to do it because in part because I had relationships with women and I knew that this could come out at some point. I didn't expect it to come out in the way that it did, but, but I, you know, I also felt like it was important to, for me because, you know, it was part of who I am. And, and I just think that the more that people like you and I talk about it, the more that, people see that it's okay. And it's, then I think the easier it'll be for the next set of people who feel like,
I will tell you, Katie, I could not agree with you more. And I did not fully anticipate everything that will come with it. There's been a lot of hatred and a lot of vitriol and a lot of assumptions and a lot of mean things that have been said. Yeah. And that is what it is. I kind of anticipated that would be the case. But my wife got a call from one of her sorority sisters who had said that a coworker of hers had come to her, and wanted to communicate because she knew that this woman knew my wife and wanted us to know something. And what she shared with her was that her son, who is this all pro, you know, athlete in high school, had on the day of my interview aired, my wife and I's interview aired on Tamron Hall's show, that he had come to her, to tell her that he was bisexual.
Was it because of your interview that he felt like he could? That
is absolutely.
That is so amazing.
But what stung us the most and stung this woman the most, which is what I think compelled her to share this, was he also shared that because he didn't know what to do with this thing that he was feeling, he had contemplated killing himself. But couldn't go all the way through it. And he told his mother this, and his mother's, you know, expressing this in tears and basically saying, if he had been successful at taking his own life, his father and I would have run ourselves raggedy trying to figure out what was wrong. Mm-hmm. They would not have known what was wrong. And they just wanted us to know, that regardless of all of what's going on out here and what we're hearing and what we're saying, that our story is helping to save lives.
That's amazing.
And RJ said in that moment that if nothing ever came from us telling our story, that this will have been enough. And for me, I feel the same way. And so, you know, the chatterbox will be the chatterbox. And as my therapist says, you know, she says, Andrew, you have to operate at a level where not every sound can reach your ear. Mm-hmm. And her point was, you have to, you know, everybody can't see what you see and they're not going to experience what you experience in. And, you know, people got different perspectives and whatnot, but you cannot give resonance to that in your, you know, in your head, in your ears.
Right.
And,
right.
It's a practice. I got to tell Katie, it's not a destination, but it's, you know, every day I have to make the choice. Every moment I have to make the choice around, what I allow into my space.
Yeah. Well, I'm so proud of you and of your family and your wife and, grateful. And I think that you have a lot of great stuff ahead. So,
I appreciate that.
Things are looking, I hope you feel that things are looking up too, because.
Well, you know what? I feel mostly, cause people have asked me like, you know, you must feel very, you know, free. And it's sort of a weird, I'm still sort of in a weird place, and it's not so much about the sexuality part. I think part of where I am still is in some of the deep therapy work.
Yeah.
You know, this is the challenge. This is why I never wanted to see a therapist before.
Because it's hard.
Is that it's extremely hard, but I kept saying to myself, all they're going to do is hash up all this old stuff from when I was a kid and this is that and the third, and they're going to break it and they won't be able to put it back together.
Right.
That was my fear, that they would unearth things that could not be put to bed again. Mm-hmm. And my therapist wanted me to, you know, communicate it to me. She says, you know, you're intense about not wanting, you know, feeling like everything is broken and it can't be put back together again. And she says, I want you to think about it from the perspective of what is broken, you no longer need. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, you're not going to put it back together the way that it was, because it wasn't meant to be together that way anyway. That's right. Why we're in this moment. Yeah. And so it's really allowing me to reconnect with, in some ways, or connect with for the first time, what's in my interest, what's in my happiness. You don't have to say yes to stuff you don't want to do. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to still be around this person who you can barely tolerate mm-hmm. just because, you know, this is that and the third. And so it's actually, Katie, for me, been like wanting to only want authentic things around and in my yeah. life. And some of that can be scary because you're cutting loose things that have otherwise been familiar. But also some of it is exciting because it feels like you got a little bit of a blank piece of paper that you can color on.
Totally. Yeah. Well, I know we're running out of time because you got to take off in just a second, but, you know, the whole idea behind this podcast is it's naked politics because
yeah.
you know, there's so much to expose, but you and I are, to my knowledge, like we're part of a very small group of people who have literally been exposed naked.
Yeah. And everybody's been exposed, but except the world has been exposed
right,
to our
right,
naked.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Yeah, totally. And that process of getting through it and coming out the other side can, it takes as long as it takes, you know, and we're still on the early, both of us are still on the early side.
For sure.
And
for sure.
Who knows what shape that's going to take. It might take, you know, we're out now, right? But we might want to go away at some point.
And yeah.
Like I'm on a road trip right now, and it's very hard for me to imagine wanting to go back into like public, real, true public life.
No, I hear you. It's so funny because everyone was like, oh, he's doing this interview. He's trying to line up to run again in 20. I was like, are you effing kidding me? Are you crazy?
I know.
I would tell you, and I can imagine it's true for you as well. You're the type of person that when you see a problem, you want to fix it.
Yeah.
It certainly is how I am. And it's one of the things that really drew me to public service. I'm like, what now? Why y'all over here complaining? Why don't we just run, take over that thing and then make it different. Right.
Yeah.
So that's in me. And I am learning that there are ways you can impact the world, with no title, at all. And that's a retraining because in all of my adulthood, from student body president of my university to board of trustee member to, you know, all the way up to the end of 2018, there was a title that I wore to allow me to do the work that I wanted to do. And I'm now relearning that isn't necessary. So,
But it's also, you're going back to, you started in advocacy, you started
as in
that kind of activism, and so did I. And so in a way, we're kind of going back to our roots with what we learned from politics and from, you know, working on the other side of things. And I think that'll make us more effective. So it's kind of, I'm glad to be on this journey with you. I'm glad we've become friends because of it.
Yes.
And we didn't even touch current events or anything like that.
I know. But you know, we can do that anytime. Katie, yeah. I'm still a very faithful person. And so I don't believe that God directed what happened with me, but I do believe he allowed it. Mm-hmm. And in the allowing is where the learning for me has really come from, because it could have been worse. I could have lost my life, right? Yeah. And so the fact that in both our situations as different or as similar as any part of it might be, we are now in a position where by our example, God knows who we might be impacting in the positive so that they don't end up in an unfortunate place. And I think there's real power in one, telling our story and owning our own individual stories. And golly, I can't wait to see what the future holds. I don't know what it looks like, but I think it's going to be bright. I think it's going to be in my being. I think it'll help to, I think it will, it, when I say in my being, in my happiness. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the one thing that kind of keeps me energized, you know, day in, day out, is that, all right, I think there's intention for my life. There's purpose for it. And even if it's not all the way clear in this moment, I'm trusting that it would become clear by and by.
Totally. Well, we're going to collaborate on things, I can just tell.
Yes. I'm in it.
Great. Well, have a great rest of your day. Thank you so much for doing this.
Of course.
hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. Andrew is a great guy, and I wish him nothing but success in his future endeavors. And I'm glad, frankly, that although the circumstances were strange and unfortunate in how we met, I'm glad, truly glad, to have become friends with him, and honored that he was my first guest. So just to wrap things up, we are going to have a lot more content coming your way. Stay tuned. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. We will have lots of episodes with some incredible guests, spontaneous ones perhaps. So stay tuned. And again, just thank you so much to Andrew. Thank you to you all for listening. And I'll talk to you soon. We're gonna get dirty on this.